You're listening to No Lies Radio, coming to you 24/7 from the San Francisco Bay Area north of Berkeley. Your radio station for the truth, peace, justice, freedom, and more power to the people.
Welcome to the special live version of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett. I do this every weekend. It's my only live show right here on the best listener-supported network of all, Revolution Radio. Please do go to freedomslips.com if you're not already there and figure out a way to donate something to keep this great listener-supported radio going. You can always go to truthjihad.com, too, and help me out personally. All right, we have a great show coming up today. It's a response to last week's show. I had Peter Myers on, and we did an episode on Harvey Weinstein. And in particular, we analyzed this through the prism of a kind of an E. Michael Jones look at the culture war between Judaism, Jewish identity, politics, or whatever, Jewish cultural milieu type of stuff. Versus Christianity and Christian culture. Now, of course, I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm a Muslim, right? So, you know. Anyway, we had a really interesting show there with Peter Myers, and a lot of people really liked it, and some people really hated it or found something offensive about it. And one of them was my first hour guest tonight. Joel Simpson is a really interesting and a very bright and insightful guy. Joel has had careers in college teaching, jazz piano, and music software. And now he's found his purpose in life as a professional photographer. So he's not only sharp analytically, but he's a creative person as well. And he's done wonderful analyses of some of the issues that we cover on this show, such as public myths versus the truth about the deep state and its crimes, that sort of thing. Joel is hip to that stuff. He's a great guy, but he thought that last week's show was a little over the top. It sounded like it was attacking Jewish people in general. Well, I didn't think it was. I certainly didn't mean it to be. So let's have a conversation, because the remedy for bad speech, or speech that you or I or anybody may think is bad, is good speech. It's not censorship. That's what we do here on Revolution Radio and on Truth Jihad Radio, is we look for the truth by talking it out. So let's see what Joel has to say. We're going to bring Joel on here. And then in the second hour, we're going to have Henry Herskovitz for a third opinion. Henry is quite notorious in Ann Arbor, Michigan for his hardcore pro-Palestine activism, one of a growing number of Jewish Americans who do that sort of thing. So that should be a lot of fun, too. But let's get going here. I believe that we have Joel Simpson on the line. Welcome, Joel. How are you?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry about the delay. I had to reload Skype.
Oh, no problem. I know how that sort of thing goes. I have my Skype issues to the point that I wonder if it's not a conspiracy sometimes.
No. I had to replace my computer, and the old Skype didn't work.
Okay. Well, glad you did it. Thank you so much. It was good to have you back.
Thank you.
We had a good show on deep state issues. What was that, almost a year ago? Or it was quite a while ago.
No, it was just about 6 months ago.
Half a year. Okay. And now we're back to revisit the issues that I discussed with Peter Myers in the show on Harvey Weinstein's disgrace, a major event in the culture war. And Peter kind of analyzes that through the E. Michael Jones prism. Sort of, you know, Jewish versus Christian culture wars. You know, E. Michael Jones thinks that there are basically three groups in America vying for power: Catholics, Protestants, and Jews. So he views our cultural history through that prism. And of course, being a very conservative Catholic who was chased out of the academy for writing a letter to the editor opposing abortion at a Catholic college, which he found a bit obnoxious, he's kind of been a pretty hardcore voice defending what he views as sort of the Catholic view of things against the Jewish and Protestant views. And in particular, he has a hard time with quote unquote Jewish Hollywood. He thinks that Jewish culture, especially sort of secular Jewish culture, has tended to attack traditional family values, Christian values. So that's E. Michael Jones's take on things. And Peter Myers seemed to analyze the Harvey Weinstein affair through that prism. and you listened and found or looked at some of the talk about the show and thought that it was verging on racism.
Well, I mean, first of all, anyone who brings up Christian values and family values, I'm immediately suspicious of. This is Bill O'Reilly territory, Kevin.
Oh no!
Oh yeah!
You know how to get to me, don't you?
That's what they talk about. I'd like someone to cite me just one of those values, and then here, I mean, Weinstein is obviously a despicable human being. Was very powerful. There was a culture that covered his sins. We see this from every ethnic group. I mean, O'Reilly turned out to be one of those people himself.
Oh yes, he's the worst of the worst.
Yeah, I mean, come on. So, and I'd like someone. If Peter Myers is standing up for a very arch conservative analysis of Jones, I'd like him to mention one of these Christian values that is being attacked, or family values. I mean, these are memes that are used by conservative politicos to rally the generally white working class people who feel very victimized, while these same politicos trounce the family values of people who don't necessarily belong to those groups, like immigrants and poor people and African Americans. I mean, it reeks of hypocrisy. And Christian values, come on. I mean, even David Brooks talks about Judeo-Christian values. Of course, he's Jewish. Really, these are very, very manipulative terms, which, to my mind, completely miss the economic oppression in this country, hypocrisy in this country. I see the dividing line as being economic underneath everything. And then on top of that, we have perhaps phony culture wars or the imagining of culture wars, which basically rally troops of pretty uneducated people. That's the way I see it.
Well, you know, that actually has been my analysis through most of my life. And after I discussed this stuff with Jones and looked at some of his work and so on, you know, I've broadened my thinking. Also, coming to Islam did give me a different take on sexual morality. You know, I in my misspent youth, I did a whole lot of things that not only are condemned by morality based in the holy books, but were really very exploitive and unkind and, you know, were the symptoms of the way that American traditional family values culture broke down in the wake of the invention and dispersal of the birth control pill. This is the kind of stuff that Jones looks at. Neocons look at it too. And many of them are extremely hypocritical. The neocon view, of course, is that they, the elite Nietzschean supermen, can run around raping everybody they can get their hands on, of whatever age, gender, or species, I assume. And O'Reilly seems to be pretty much like that. But the plebs, the lumpen proletariat, you know, the hoi polloi should be regulated by this morality imposed from above. And so they kind of, you know, believe that the elite is supposed to impose a religious myth to control the masses. And of course, that is incredibly hypocritical. And we get a lot of that kind of manipulation in our political system. At the same time, you know, when I've gone back and thought this through and looked at, for instance, you know, the neocons talk about how the divorce rate in America has skyrocketed from the 1950s, when divorce was still very uncommon. That was my parents' generation originally, to then the birth control pill comes along in the 1960s. And pretty soon by the 70s, a lot of my parents' generation, their friends were getting divorced. Kids were suffering horribly through this. You know, a child's worst nightmare often is, you know, a family breakup. And this has happened now to practically a majority of people and a sizable majority in some demographic groups. So looking at all of this, keeping in mind that in my opinion, you know, the purpose of life is spiritual growth, not material enjoyment, that one's capacity for inner peace, which is the what spiritual growth is all about. A lot of that is set in the earliest few years of life, and having a stable family taking care of one is the key to that. So really the most important thing that we all should be doing on earth is making sure that the first few years of children's lives are extremely stable and well cared for in a very, very strongly structured relationship that the kids can count on. Given all of that, my new way of looking at the world, very different from how I looked at the world in the past, I think that there is something to this critique of moral breakdown and this rhetoric coming out of people like Michael Jones that condemns the spread of hedonism and values that used to be bohemian values to the entire culture, primarily through the influence of Hollywood. And the fact that Hollywood is almost totally dominated by people from a Jewish background who are non-religious, and those people have been at having a culture war with the Catholics who are trying to keep a lid on sexual morality in film. The Catholics pushed through the decency code back in 1930, and then Hollywood busted it wide open in the 60s at the same time the pill came along, and simultaneously busted open America's values. So I think there's something to the Jones analysis.
Could I respond to that? First of all,
please do.
I was about to say, until you got to the movies, just that your misspent youth, just like St. Augustine.
Yeah. I think, you know, great minds think and act alike. Christian or Muslim, doesn't matter.
The social history of America is a multi-stranded, extremely complex thing. First of all, just to add another strand, there's the strand of feminism and the fact that women were earning less, were kept out of the job market to a large extent in the 50s when I grew up, stifled, subjected to male dominance, and the pill and the rising divorce rate were both signs of the liberation into full personhood of women. But there was a downside, of course. Now, when you say the rise of divorce, does that mean realistically looking at the emptiness of the relationships, or taking the other perspective, maybe people were expecting more from marriage than simply the agreement to raise children and have a bank account together. Maybe they wanted love. Maybe they wanted a soulmate. These are things that were not great values in the 19th century, for example. Love was a luxury. It occasionally occurred. What about all the marriages of convenience, and where was women's power in those days? So that's happened at the same time that wealth has been concentrated, work has been degraded, blue collar jobs that you could get without a college education that used to pay well, that where people could afford houses in the suburbs and boats, for God's sakes, are gone. So there's been a huge slippage, just of wealth in the majority of the population as inequality has increased. This has produced great strife in families, great friction in families. At the same time, women's economic status has improved, but also there are these other negative influences. Absolutely, sexploitation, nudity, certain barriers have come down. But also, and of course, there'll always be a crass commercial culture, always. And the Jews who clearly were in positions of power in Hollywood exploited this, as any group would have, and other groups in other sectors of the economy and culture exploited it just as materialistically, just as crassly. On the other hand, we've had some real breakthroughs in film, real truth telling. What was the film that Mary Tyler Moore was in where she played the rather rigid mother? Postcards from the Edge. That was another. There have been some very, very good movies about real family dynamics and family conflicts. It's not easy negotiating these things. I was brought up in a family that externally looked very peaceful and supportive, and was, and we had enough money, but there were deep conflicts underneath. My father was threatening divorce throughout the 70s, had an affair. They never did break up, and they eventually made up sometime in the 90s after about 30 years of strife. But
that's a happy ending story.
Yeah, my parents were born in 1915 and 16. If they had been born in the 30s, they might have broken up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is what I object to in David Brooks's moral fables in his columns. You know, he takes one statistic and draws a huge moral lesson from it. You can't. These are very, very complex, multi-stranded things with some improvements, some devolutions. And then, you know, to come to a conclusion that we have been on a moral decline because divorce has increased. And of course, now suicide has increased too. This is another story. And then look at Hollywood, and Hollywood has made all these crass exploitative films, and Hollywood is dominated by Jews. Therefore, these are very linear conclusions. And social life is not like that. It's much, much more complex.
Well, I actually agree with you there. You know, when I do this kind of analysis and I listen to Peter Myers or Michael Jones, I'm not thinking, aha, this explains everything. I'm thinking, aha, this is one important strand that has been very much repressed. You know, since this show is basically about important matters that are repressed, that's why I go there with it. You know, you see Joel Stein, for example, writing his piece, you know, do Jews run Hollywood? Come on. And then Abe Foxman from the ADL just pounces on him and says, this is terrible. You're so racist. Joel Stein, of course, is Jewish himself and is like celebrating the fact that Jews totally dominate Hollywood and saying, oh, get off it, you hypocrite. And yet this is really not something that is discussed very much in the mainstream culture. And when anybody tries to mention it, especially from a critical perspective, Joel Stein kind of gets, you know, he didn't lose his job and never work in this town again for talking about Jewish domination of Hollywood because he likes it. Whereas if somebody like Michael Jones talks about Jewish domination of Hollywood and is critical of it, then he's just automatically kicked out of town. So you're only allowed to have one side of this, put out one side of this discussion. And I think that's wrong. That's unbalanced. I want to hear that other side, too.
Oh, but the other side has to have some intellectual integrity and some validity. To say that let's say Jews predominate in Hollywood. Actually, when Hollywood came to be founded, in the teens and 20s of the last century, Jews were found it much more difficult to excel in many other seriously wealth-producing professions, banking, the railroads, all kinds of manufacturing, steel. These were all closed to Jews, and the great moguls of those industries certainly were not Jewish. Hollywood was open. It certainly gave Jews a platform for certain things in the Jewish character, the humor, the performance, the sense of sensitivity to public trends. But then to narrow it down to say, well, Hollywood is to blame for the degradation of our values. That's extremely simplistic, since there were so many other pressures, and I tend to be economic about this material, you know, I tend to look to the material pressures first. The loss of wealth in the middle class and the working class. And then with this very narrow analysis to then appeal to Christian values without really saying what they are, and family values, which is such a hypocritical meme, and then to make a moral judgment, a condemnation of the Jews of Hollywood, that's why this is so objectionable.
How about the specific issue of Harvey Weinstein's specifically Jewy perviness, as Tablet magazine put it, in which he seemingly acted out a kind of a revenge fantasy, as they said at Tablet Magazine, against the shiksas, which is a pejorative term for non-Jewish women. Tablet Magazine had the courage to explore this, and then they had to apologize for putting out that article. It seems to me that in the popular discourse and legitimate, you know, mainstream discourse in the West, one is allowed to say anything, you know, positive or even neutral about Jewish people of any kind. But there's such a taboo on bringing up anything negative. So in this case, you know, we're constantly hearing about quote unquote anti-Semitism, which is obviously a misnomer since Jews are not Semitic. They're not Semites, and Arabs are the real Semites. But we hear so much about this. People are imprisoned for doing historiography that offends Jewish people, basically. But you can do all the historiography you want in every other Holocaust and come up with whatever numbers you want and so on, and you're never going to have a problem. And so we get a totally one-sided discourse. And so we get this notion that non-Jewish people are, you know, always in danger of hating on Jewish people. Yet, what about the other side? Isn't there a lot of similar prejudice from Jewish people against the Goyim? And when you see Weinstein acting out these fantasies of degrading the shiksas, I mean, this, I think it needs to be noticed, and we should talk about it, and we should rebalance the discussion and say, there's a problem. The problem is both prejudice against Jews and Jewish prejudice against non-Jews. And it seems to me, which came first, the chicken or the egg? I don't know.
Well, remember that until just yesterday, maybe the 60s, 70s, it was very okay, even fashionable, to be anti-Semitic in upper-class American circles. The Gentleman's Agreement. I grew up in that period, and in Hebrew school we had a whole chapter on anti-Semitism, and that changed as Norman Finkelstein points out in 1967 when the Israelis showed that they were powerful militarists, and all of a sudden conservatives of the world started admiring them, and the old style of anti-Semitism became a dead letter, except among people like Steve Bannon and these troglodytes who really preserve this old style anti-Semitism, which Hannah Arendt dealt with very, very well, very perceptively in The Origins of Totalitarianism, which is really three books in one. And the first book is called Anti-Semitism. When I read this in the early 70s, I said, oh, anti-Semitism is like the poor man's sociology. It's like the explanation, the ignorant explanation for why there are a certain number of dysfunctions. Now, when you look at Harvey Weinstein, and he's cited several times in this article. Oh, wait, the Gentiles, right. First of all, let me remind you that shiksa is not, it's not always a pejorative term. It's a kind of ironic term, and in its origin, it's really a fatalistic term. Shiksa, if you look at the German origin of the word, it's, which is really Schicksal. Schicksal means fate in German. So it's the Jewish mother wringing her hands, tearing her hair, and holding her head that her dear son is going after this beautiful blonde woman. And she says, she bemoans it as fate and gives the nickname of fate to the non-Jewish woman.
Well, that's kind of humorous, but isn't that also kind of bigoted? I mean, if my mom doesn't want me to marry a Muslim or a dark-skinned person, I mean, or anybody outside of her white Protestant group, that's racism and bigotry. So why isn't what this Jewish mother is doing racism and bigotry?
Well, but Kevin, you have to realize that at this time, that I'm talking about, which is 19th and early 20th century, the Jews are very much an embattled people. They are still suffering from massive anti-Semitism, exclusion, enormous social barriers, even in the United States.
Wait a minute. With all these social barriers, do you think that in all of these times when Jews are alleged to have been so massively discriminated against, if you went back, you took the average level of wealth, income, etc., of the average person, who's usually going to be a peasant probably until well into the 19th century when the average person is now a factory worker, you take the average person and you compare that to the average Jewish person, you really think the average Jewish person is doing worse?
Well, in the 19th century, remember, before the Holocaust, when you say the average Jewish person, we're looking at an enormous amount of diversity that included huge numbers of poor Jews in Eastern Europe. The majority of Jews at that time were really quite poor. Now, when they came to this country, they didn't suffer the same legal strictures. In certain countries, Jews couldn't own property, or they couldn't farm. And so they did better. I mean, they prized education. There are two traits that are specifically culturally Jewish that I was brought up knowing about. One is that Jews are rarely alcoholics, and two is that there's very little physical abuse in Jewish families. I don't know if this continues to be true, and now I hear that in the Orthodox community in New York, there is considerable abuse. But those two facts alone make for more productive childhoods, very largely speaking. We're talking about the early 20th century now.
So these are actually positive family values.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and education, too, is obviously a very positive Jewish family value. This bar mitzvah thing, getting, you know, everybody literate, really focusing on education and so on. Absolutely. Well, today...
Learning to swim, by the way. That's another thing. A Jewish kid learns to swim.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh, yeah. That was very much part of the upbringing. You went to Hawaii and you learned to swim.
Yeah, that was, well, whatever background I'm from, which is some kind of mixed white bread Protestant, you know, background from, you know, sort of mixture of immigrants and Anglos here in the Midwest. It was learning to swim was also big time. Well, it seems that today Jews, okay, I'll agree with you that in the past there was a lot of poverty in Jewish communities. There was also some extreme wealth. You know, Rothschilds were doing pretty well in the 19th century, to say the least. Today there's very little poverty in American Jewish communities. I am friends with the only Jewish homeless guy in San Francisco. When I was living in a vehicle in San Francisco, my fellow vehicle dweller, Bob, I won't mention his last name, but he's been in the newspaper out there, was one of the most notorious of the vehicle dwellers. Anyway, Bob and I are, you know, he's the only San Francisco era friend I really stay in touch with. And, he's, you know, poor as a church mouse, although he does manage to accumulate a fair amount of material junk and keep it in the vehicles that he strews around the streets of San Francisco, one step ahead of the police. Bob is quite an interesting guy, a talented poet. Anyway, so he's like the last Jewish poor person in America, and I actually know him. but clearly there's been an improvement economically.
Yeah, but that's speaking overall. Of course, there's a great deal of wealth in the Jewish community. Jews have generally done well, but there are also certain Jewish types that account for people who don't do well. The Shlemiel, for example.
He's the guy who spills soup on the Shlemazel, right?
Right. The Shlemazel means someone who's terribly unlucky, and the Shlemiel can never really get it together. And the closeness in the family also has a downside. And in fact, when I was growing up, and we had a certain amount of dysfunction in my family, and my friends and my parents entertained quite a lot, as I grew up and got to know these people from a more adult perspective, I saw that virtually every one of them had children who were not doing well, who were not succeeding, who needed help from the family for a long time. And there was something wrong, something neurotically wrong with everyone. And of course, coming from within the Jewish community and being part of this sector of it, I'm very aware of the, shall we say, the family neuroses that are favored by Jews. And every ethnic group has them, has their own. Mm-hmm. There's no perfect ethnic group. I would say that that there's a high incidence of covert incest in Jewish families.
Woody Allen might be evidence of that.
Sure, I mean he makes light of it, and he also did very well by bringing it out. I mean before he got involved with younger women and betrayed his wife. He was in psychoanalysis 4 days a week for years to
look at where it got him
to work. Yeah. And he succeeded very well. He was a brilliant guy. He worked out his personal problems, his family problems, and he did very well. But his type of family problems tend to be a high, let's say, have high incidence in the Jewish community. I'm trying not to generalize, but there are certain tendencies in every ethnic group.
Yes.
Healthy tendencies and less healthy tendencies.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And this is how I frame this discussion with Peter Myers. I certainly don't frame it as, say, you know, an attempt to cast Jewish people in general or the U.S. Jewish community, even the Hollywood Jewish community, in a universally negative light. I see it as an attempt to expose something to the light that is not talked about. And that's, it's just one side of this thing. Just as every ethnic group has its positive and negative traits, Jews do too. And today we're in this weird post-Holocaust world where you're not allowed to talk about any of the negative traits of Jews. And so we have this genocide going on over in Palestine, supported by an awful lot of people in the American Jewish community. We can't really let it rip when we fight it because we're going to be called racists.
Well, but that's another issue entirely, and one that I've devoted a lot of energy and thought to, that Netanyahu and his ilk are trying to take over the meme of anti-Semitism and saying anyone who opposes Israel is automatically anti-Semitic, which is ridiculous. It means you can't stand up for human rights. If you do, you're anti-Semitic, which is a complete contradiction, and a total moral turpitude, which I condemn in the strongest terms. But this is Zionism. This is not Judaism. What I ask about is, give me some concrete value that Jewish Hollywood supposedly is responsible for undermining, that's not also, and even in a much stronger way, a product of economic change and in many instances, the positive rise of feminism. See, I think it's much too easy and rests on an old prejudice to attribute this to something Jewish. And Weinstein in particular is a despicable person who used his power for abuse. He belongs in jail, and his embrace of Israel is simply the most conventional, easiest way for a rich person to curry favor. Let me remind you that virtually the whole U.S. Congress is in the same position, and it's been since the 1967 war.
Well, here's I think the argument I've heard from Mike Jones, which is what Peter Myers was sort of implicitly supporting.
Yeah.
Would be that there's this sort of culture clash in the U.S. between religious groups. And so the Catholics are early on in the teens and 20s horrified by what's coming out of Hollywood already at that point. And so they push through their decency code because that's the, you know, they don't want to see any nudity. They don't want to see any sexuality outside, you know, basically virtually no sexuality. And this, you know, this is a kind of religiously based value in Islam. We basically do say no public sexuality, period. And that's why in Iran, the Islamic Republic, you go outside, you don't see billboards with half-naked women trying to sell you stuff. Why, you know, the cultural meme for showing that women are spiritual beings, not sexual beings to look at, is the headscarf. So this is part of Islamic culture. Sex is something that's totally 100% private between a married couple, and that's it. Anything outside of that is extremely considered bad. And so that's the Catholic values here were a little bit like that. Divorce was absolutely prohibited among Catholics for a very long time, and it's still many Catholics think it should be. I'm sure Mike Jones does. So there is this is the approach that we're talking about. And then Jewish Hollywood, which is, it seems that I think what Mike Jones would say, there's some kind of psychosexual thing going on where not only are Jewish people who are doing well in Hollywood finding they can make some money by creating this quite amazing entertainment industry and putting out these motion pictures, but they also are kind of taking pot shots at the Christian values because
Christian values?
There's been this conflict with Christianity historically. And so just as Harvey Weinstein is taking pot shots by degrading shiksas, Hollywood is taking pot shots at Christian values by trying to show more skin, trying to be naughtier and naughtier, and finally blowing up the decency code and creating this world that we're in now, or helping contribute to it, where porn is available to everybody with the click of a mouse.
Okay, this is several issues. Now, first of all, you're saying that somehow Christianity was opposed to what we call, frankly, the sexual revolution.
Of course.
Which was a liberation, which is viewed as a liberation. Of course, it was in certain ways perverted. Of course, in certain ways, it became the pretext for the exploitation of women and the spread of pornography. And feminists are very articulate about this. But also, it brought sexuality into the discussion rather than keeping it under the table. You know, St. Paul had serious psychosexual problems and bequeathed them to the Christian religion, which is...
Yeah, that's what Gore Vidal seems to think.
Also Joseph Campbell, who made the point that he's pretty much critical of every organized religion, and his take on Catholicism is that it had the arrogance of imagining that a religious authority could take over natural functions of the body, which Jewish culture never did, and neither did other religions.
Islam regulated things primarily, I think, to make sure that all children had somebody taking care of them. But this is the anthropological function of the family. It's essentially to tame male sexuality, which would normally basically just loot and rape, loot, and pillage all it could, unless you have a social structure that channels it toward all of that testosterone-fueled libidinal energy towards caring for women and children. So that's why in Islam, every man it's absolutely forbidden to have any sexual activity whatsoever unless you're essentially in a relationship where you're taking care of the women and the children forever.
Of course, now we have weekend marriages and divorces in Iran, for example.
That's true. And that's a symptom of a kind of decline that you could compare to what's happened in America since the pill.
But to go back in history, this has been a human conundrum since prehistory. But the original way it was solved, since the ascension of male power in the fourth millennium BCE, when the Godhead switched from being earth-based and female to being sky-based when astronomy was discovered, the organization of the heavenly bodies in the fourth millennium, about 3300 BCE, which was a major, major revolution in human, I'm not going to get this.
It's probably a caller wanting to call into the show.
Yeah, right. No, I can't read. I mean, anyway, which was the invention of the wheel, the invention of pottery, and the discovery of the organization of astronomy, and the god became a male sky god, and all of the organized religions of our day are descended from that period. We don't have any more earth-based, planter-based major religions. You find that anthropologists discover them, of course. Now, the point I'm trying to make...
Wait a minute. Allahu Rabbu Samawati wal Ard, God is the God of the heavens and the earth. I mean, it's not just in the sky.
Well, of course. He dominates the earth.
He's not a sky god. I mean, in Islam anyway, which is the same as the Godhead in Christianity and some Judaism, God is beyond these categories. God is a transcendent category.
Yeah, but God is a male figure.
No, not in Islam. In Islam, the first two tangible characteristics are Rahman Rahim. That comes from the word for womb. So God is actually, if anything, God would be more female and maternal than male and paternal in Islam. I've argued this with Mike Jones, who thinks God is
that's
God.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. But still, the point I'm trying to make is that the stabilization of male sexuality, the problem that you brought up and that you said is solved by a strong family culture that Christianity supposedly represents, was solved in previous eras by the virtual possession of women, the denial of women their own will and their own ability to fulfill themselves as people in the same way that men are given. And you still see this in traditional cultures today. You certainly see it in Saudi Arabia, who's just now granting women the right to drive, for God's sakes. So this is part of the oppression of women. Unfortunately, there's no simple answer that solves all problems. You liberate women and then you get all breakdowns in other areas. And then when you combine that with increasing inequality and the actions of the deep state over the last 50 years to control more and more of the wealth of the country. I believe this is really the most subversive force. And then the cultural things are kind of surface phenomena that deserve an analysis, but they're certainly not the cause. And when someone like Jones or David Brooks comes along and says, you know, we're increasing the divorce rates, there's obviously a drop in morality, what's to blame? So Brooks blames one thing and Jones blames Jews. I mean, that's such cheap sociology. I don't even take it seriously.
Well, yeah, I haven't read Brooks. I think Jones is definitely worth reading and thinking about. But I agree with you, though, that the neocons in particular are guilty of a kind of a glib reductionism when they look back at the 1950s when divorce rates were very low, when crime rates were much lower. And, you know, when for, especially like in African American families, divorce rates were quite low in African American families in the 40s and 50s. And now they're, you know, the majority of African American children are born out of wedlock. And so all of these changes, many of which are quite obviously negative, the neocons analyze this and say it's about the breakdown of the family. We have to go back to traditional values, blah, blah, blah. But they don't want to pay a living wage to people in, you know, manual labor jobs. They don't want to have any jobs available for working class people. So this is, you know, it's totally ridiculous.
There's no intellectual integrity among the neocons. They're just shills for the 1%. They refuse to look at the underlying economic realities and the causes for this increased inequality, which is my quarrel with Joseph Stiglitz, too. He analyzes it, but he won't go so far as to talk about the deep state agendas and how they actually operate. And here, everything is related. The election corruption is related to the Koch brothers' founding of the Tea Party movement. These are the things that are gnawing away at the prospect of fulfillment and happiness for the large majority of people in this country. And the opioid epidemic is merely a symptom, and it's happening in rural white America. These people are losing out big time.
Well, and I largely agree with a lot of this.
Trump comes along and throws them a bone, and they follow him, and then they'll give up on him at a certain point because he's another false prophet. And our media are not giving us a full account of these deep state agendas, which I'm using as a very general term. I mean, Peter Dale Scott calls it deep state similar to a weather system. It's not something monolithic and organized, but it is very much there. It has an agenda, and there are certain ways that it propagates itself that the mainstream media will not touch. And this is my, I object to this. And then we get people on the surface, skating on the surface like Michael Jones, trying to make sense of this from a very, very superficial perspective and extremely self-righteous and extremely empty intellectually. And, you know, I'm reading Toynbee, for example. I don't have time to read Michael Jones. Anyway, I'm sorry.
I don't think Jones is superficial. I think he may be rigid. Yeah. He's very much inside of his Catholic worldview.
Tell me what he says. Convince me of one thing that's valid in what he says. So far, I'm not convinced of any of it.
Well, if you read his history books, which is mostly what he's doing is historiography, he's presenting to us the kind of the religious discourses of the times and interpreting them in a way that you may or may not agree with, but I wouldn't call it shallow. I mean, he's doing a lot of reading to come up with his results. But I do think that you're onto something by emphasizing the economic roots of the problem. You know, I voted for Bernie Sanders, obviously not Trump. But what, you know, the difference between a Bernie Sanders and a Trump is that Bernie Sanders is focusing on the way that ordinary working people are being screwed in our current society. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. And that is the reason for most of the family breakdown and crime and the kinds of problems that this moral discourse locates in the moral arena. So I agree with you there. Trump comes along with Steve Bannon and tries to make it a kind of an identity politics issue, and to some extent a sort of this type of, you know, Jewish, Christian, whatever kind of issue. And I do agree that that's largely distraction. That's part of the reason that Trump has really messed with the alternative world. The world of alternative thinkers, which I've been in the middle of for 15 years, really took a wrong turn when a lot of people on our side, even some people on the left, like Jim Petras, who I hope to have on the show pretty soon again, kind of fell for this nationalistic talk that Trump was putting out. You know, and Jim Petras, he's never going to fall for this moral discourse of Mike Jones, but he was seduced by this kind of populism of people like Trump and Bannon. So I think you're right that there's something superficial, wrong, and dangerous in the turn that some of the folks supporting those guys are taking. I certainly don't want to be contributing to that, but I want to be airing out all information that's available. And whenever there's any pressure to suppress a particular kind of talk, my job is to amplify those voices that are being suppressed and listen to them and then try to, you know, critique them and understand what's really going on.
Well, listen, I applaud you in that. Of course, there's a lot of garbage out there, too, and you have to use your good judgment. But your judgment might not be the same as mine, and you experiment with things, and you explore things. I don't argue with that, and I'm thrilled that you're having me on the show to respond to this. See, the proper role of government is not to set morality. It's, of course, punish those who violate certain rules that morality also sustains, but it's to make sure that people have a fair shot at fulfillment and prosperity.
Well, that's the American ideology.
Yeah, it used to be that governments upheld specific religions. You know, and that's what Bernie Sanders is doing. But
an alternative worldview. I did dabble with anarchism back in the day, and I still have a little bit of that in me. And I kind of agree with the famous anthropologist Clifford Geertz, who said that we have the choice of being oppressed either by the government or by our own cousins. He talks about how in traditional societies, the enforcement of social rules comes from families, not from governments. And I would add religions. Religions and families have worked together to control and, you know, limit our ways of egotistically harming each other. And so, in a sense, I think that, you know, we're living in a world where the individual fulfillment, the pursuit of happiness, is held out to be the highest value, as you just suggested, Joel. And I would argue that no, inner peace and spiritual development, which comes from overcoming the ego, overcoming desire, as the Buddhists would agree, that's the highest value. To get that inner peace, will the government create a society that's well-ordered that will give us that inner peace? Well, maybe, but I actually think the traditional world in which the cousins oppressed each other and religion oppressed everybody, quote-unquote, actually, that gave us a overall, considering especially the economic level of development, a vastly better world for human development than what we've got today with a society that does real well materially, but we're totally crushed by our government and by the deep state. Our spirit is crushed. We're not living in a world that's the least bit conducive to inner peace. Our media messages are constantly making us dissatisfied, churning up that desire that the Buddhists say is the root of all suffering, and they are right. So I actually side overall with the traditionalists who would argue for a world governed by family and extended family. I mean, under religion, and that would be a world with very little government.
Well, there are positive things to say about this, things that we've lost, but two things. Always remember that in these traditional societies, you must also look at the power structure. Who had the power, and how did they handle nonconformists? Because they're always, and how did they handle gay people, for example? American Indians were very tolerant of gay people. The traditional religions, Judaism included, were not terribly tolerant of gay people.
The traditional worldview in a lot of the world, including the Islamic world, is there's no such thing as gay people. All people are capable of all forms of sexual activity. Some are allowed and some are not allowed. And gay sexual activity is just not allowed.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, if you look at Brazilian culture and Greek culture, you'll see a much more of a continuum, a sexual continuum rather than a sexual identity. But it's true, as my anthropologist ex-girlfriend pointed out to me, there's something like 20 things that have to happen during gestation for a standard heterosexual baby to be born. And if any of these malfunction, then you're not going to get a standard sexuality. And 10% of every human population falls into this category of being attracted by the same sex. So this is just a human phenomenon that most traditional religions have not dealt with a great deal of tolerance and grace.
That's a good point, you know, or it could be, you know, I don't know. But that's an argument that could lead traditional religions to rethink their approach to these things.
In
Islam, sexual, these issues they come out of the Sodom and Gomorrah story, just like in the Jewish and Christian traditions. And it seems very clear that there is a strong, you know, injunction against same-sex sexuality. It's possible, however, to interpret that as a particular kind of extremely aggressive same-sex sexuality that is being despised in terms of behavior in Sodom and Gomorrah.
Oh, yeah, well, in certainly biblical times and until very recently, gay sexuality, homosexuality was looked upon with opprobrium and punished severely in Great Britain, for example. You could be jailed for it. Oscar Wilde was martyred for it, for example. We lost a great genius in the flower of his creativity. He only had about 10 years of success. No, there have been great crimes committed out of fear of homosexuality. Tchaikovsky had to commit suicide because he had a homosexual affair with a young aristocrat. No, there's the stories are many, many. But
haven't we maybe gone to the other extreme of sort of overly celebrating all of these kinds of deviations from the norm?
We're tolerating them. We're recognizing people for who they are and giving them the right to love whomever they want. The other point I wanted to make is that we're at a point in our political evolution where government no longer seems to be capable of truly solving problems. Government is paralyzed. It refuses to look at serious problems. And you and I both know that there are specific lies that have been perpetrated about major events in our history. And to me, these are like the seeds of government's incapacity to really look truthfully and take strong measures. And we're talking about the Kennedy assassination, 9/11, and so forth, the King assassination. So all of these have been covered up. These are the basic lies at the base of the modern consciousness that's perpetrated by our media, and in its governmental manifestation, we don't have a Congress that is willing to solve problems. I mean, we're now backtracking on clean air and water. Puerto Rico is being left to hang out and dry. It's terrible. We're not solving our problems, and we're spending huge amounts of money for permanent war. These are the values that are really at stake, even perhaps more so than family values. If our government actually spent our wealth on the people, there would be so much more opportunity and development, and the space would open for more people to pursue their spiritual maturity. As it is now, some people have to work so hard just to keep their heads above water, and then they're in conflict over material issues that there's very little space left for
and then they come home and there's Bill O'Reilly on TV, loviating at them. I guess he's still going to be on for a while.
False consciousness.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Joel Simpson. Appreciate your insights, and hope to have you back again soon. Like to pick up this conversation. There are several things I would like to have gotten to, Douglas Hofstadter, the paranoid stuff. And I'm looking for my guest from the other side of the world and realize, I think I got that time zone mixed up, or even worse, the date zone. The international dateline can sometimes really mess you over when you're doing guests from around the world, which I've been doing now for quite some time. And particular with this time slot I've got now, it works really well for people over in Asia, Australia, places like that, as long as I can remember that international dateline. Doesn't work so well for Europe, though. I don't get European guests as much. They have to stay up till 2, 3 in the morning. Every now and then, there's somebody who will do that, like Ian Greenhall, who was on last week. Anyway, I'm going to just go one time zone over for my guest right now. That's Henry Herskovitz. Henry Herskovitz is with Daryazine Remembered, Witnesses for Peace, and he's out there every Saturday picketing his local synagogue in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And he occasionally has run-ins with some of the locals there. One of them, a certain Jessica Leibowitz, had the temerity to steal his sign. When was that? I don't know when that was, a while back. And she just got sentenced for doing that. Jessica Leibowitz is a lawyer in Ann Arbor, and apparently she didn't have a very good defense. You shouldn't run around stealing people's signs, especially if they are, you know, they're expressing themselves. This is America, right? First Amendment, right to protest. Well, it looks like justice triumphed, and Jessica is going to have to do some community service. So chalk one up for the good guys. Hey, welcome, Henry Herskovitz. How's it going?
It's going pretty good, Kevin. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good to have you back on. So the sign-stealing caper was finally resolved.
After well more than a handful of attacks and assaults on us, the prosecuting attorney's office finally came around and did something. Of course, it was really helped with that that video that I had made of it from the GoPro. So I have a body cam on me when I'm out there, and that really puts an end to the he said she said stuff that the police can't get their hands around.
Hey, body cams are not a bad idea in certain circumstances. I think every cop should probably be fitted with one while on duty.
Yeah.
But maybe every protester in front of a synagogue should be as well.
Well, really, I mean, if you said, you know, Henry Herskovitz slugged me, and I said, no, I didn't, what would a police officer do? I mean, let's assume he's a real human being, which I do. I have a great relationship with the police department here in this town. You know, what's he going to do? But if you show him the film of me not hitting you, then he knows who's lying and who's telling the truth.
So well, there you go. And so yeah. Jessica got caught red-handed. Jessica now, did she steal one sign, many signs? What did the sign say? Give us some of those details.
Do you really want the whole story? Because
no, just the short version.
Well, the short version is that that her father, Victor Lieberman, and he was the one that declined to debate with you, if you remember.
Yeah, he's your nemesis.
Yes.
I really wanted to get him on the show. I have such a hard time getting pro-Israel people on the show. I have lots of Jewish guests, people from Jewish backgrounds, people like you from Jewish background who don't consider yourself Jewish, but most of the people I have on from Jewish backgrounds still consider themselves Jewish. And the trouble is, the ones who will come on my show, like Joel Simpson, who was on the first hour, he's a great guy, generally don't support Israel. So, you know, come on, somebody who actually likes Israel and wants to try to defend it, come on my show. Please email me. I have one stalker who keeps volunteering, but this guy, man, I'm not going to have him on because he stalked me under many names for years and years, stalked one of my events in person, and just a really slimy individual. I don't want that guy on my show. I want like a real, honest, normal person, not a stalker, with a real name who wants to defend Israel. Please get in touch with me. Come on my show.
You got to remember that these gangsters are smart, and they're not going to have their laundry aired in public. That they do, though, when they take this. I have a copy here of the Washtenaw Jewish News, and page they've devoted an entire page to us. And clearly, this was written by Professor Lieberman, but it's hidden under the byline of Washtenaw Jewish News staff writers. The title of this article is "Ann Arbor Picketers and the Charlottesville Nazis."
So you guys are like the Nazis.
Well, I'd be really ashamed if I was a Nazi. I'd say, come on, you keep dragging us out of the closet and bashing people over the heads with us. We're getting tired of this stuff, you know. Maybe people should look at what Nazi did and what Nazis were and what they did do and what they didn't do.
I mean, I forget whose law that is. Somebody or other's law is that whoever brings up the Nazis first loses the argument.
is that right? Well, that's great. I mean, it was, they've devoted an entire page to us. And the story of the sign begins with the very first line in here. And it is a quote. It says, "I'm an anti-Semite. I hate Jews. Whatever happened to them in World War II, they brought on themselves. They deserved everything they got." Now, that was a statement uttered by me in complete rage and frustration at Victor Lieberman. And the goal was to get him to go away.
Jeez, so, he provoked you.
He provoked me so much that I just went to, you know, and this is a lesson for me, that, you know, you don't engage in sarcasm with your enemy because they'll use those lines against you. And they've been using it against me since September of 2015 in print. When it first came out, I wrote a one-line letter to the editor and I said clearly, you know, neither I nor anybody in our group believes Jews deserved what they got in the Second World War. And they just refuse to print that or even acknowledge it. And so last winter, with my little GoPro on my chest, Victor comes marching down the street and he says, "Good job, Henry. You only got three people here. Heil Hitler." Oh, so he says Heil Hitler. Then I got captured on my GoPro. It's now on... It's now on the web, I can link that to you or your audience or whatever. So what I did then is I made a sign that says, "Professor Victor Lieberman, quote, Heil Hitler, !" quote. And that's the sign that provoked his daughter to come and try to steal it.
You can almost make a reality TV show out of this.
I mean, I admit to the pettiness of it, and I would give her the sign if the Washington Jewish News would just exercise some minimal journalistic standards and say, "Well, we do have a rebuttal to this. You know, the guy says, you know, this, you know, that the Jews did not deserve."
So have you posted this Lieberman video footage of him saying Heil Hitler? That actually could make an amusing video. You could actually run it over and over and over. So he's like the Peter Sellers character, you know, Dr. Strangelove, like doing the Hitler salute over and over reflexively, you know, like a knee-jerk reaction. Heil Hitler, Heil Hitler, Heil Hitler. Make a 5-minute video of him repeatedly heiling Hitler.
Put it on if I was smart enough, I could do that. But it is on YouTube. And it's a, you know, I, of course, before I did that, I checked with my Jewish attorney friend, and you must have many, and I said, "Can I do this?" And he said, "If he said it, you can do it. That's your defense." So that's the petty on petty going on around here.
Yeah, quotes out of context. Don't you just love them? I mean, I get that all the time because, let's face it, I enjoy sarcasm and irony and these multiple voiced kinds of, you know, echoes of voices and so on. You know, I studied Bakhtin when I was in literary school, and he's the literary theorist who showed us how voices echo within voices echo within voices. So he was into irony and parody and things like that. And so I just naturally tend to do that a little bit. But when you say something ironically or you're doing a parody and they don't get it, you know, it can get you into trouble.
Right. And it has. And I've learned my lesson. But, I mean, it seems to be ongoing. I mean, you know, they keep trying to hit me over the head with a statement that I made in with irony, you know, with fully sarcastic. You know, it can be easily settled by anybody that can just say, "Henry, do you believe that the Jews deserved everything they got in the Second World War?" And I would say unequivocally no. So, you know, but nobody wants to take the time. Nobody wants to take the energy to think about what's going on. We really have a heavy dose of groupthink going on around here. And it's very unfortunate that otherwise pretty sophisticated and intelligent people just roll with the punches and don't want to be bothered with Building 7, for instance, or or gas chambers or 6 million. You know, their lives are going to be too convoluted if they go into that. So they just want to push it aside. And then people like me and you get pushed aside, or they try to. And people like you and me keep sticking in their craw. And one of the comments I got from this article was that we really are a burr under the saddle of the Jewish community. And that's not our goal, is just to be a burr. But our goal certainly is to bring to light facts that have been hidden for decades. And we want to, expose this. I mean, how many Americans know that the United States government pays $10 million a day to the state of Israel? You know, that's one of our signs. You know, we don't know. But we do know that we're getting a lot of, you know, when someone comes by with a thumbs up at our vigils, drives by, it's kind of, you know, maybe, of course, I'm thinking this too much, but it seems to be, to me, to be a very knowledgeable thumbs up, like that he gets it, that the influence of the Israeli firsters, the Jewish power lobby, is very corrosive to this country's interests. And I've never been a flag saluting citizen of the United States, but ever since I've become more aware of the deleterious effects of Jewish power on our government, I mean, something's going on when the only topic that brings both houses or both sides of the house together in our Congress is Israel, or now anti-Iran bills that are being passed by the handful in the Congress. I mean, and so there is something going on, and you can just tell it's not in the best interest of our country. And one of the things I do now like about our country, and it's always been there, has been freedom of speech. And I think, like you pointed out in your introduction, that's the the weapon that I think that they really fear. Otherwise, why would they spend, you know, a full page of their newspaper, 20 pages in all, on a detailed Henry bashing article when we're just a handful of people, you know, that just stand in a place that they don't want us to stand for an hour and a half every week. That's all we do. I mean, I wished I was as focused as you, and certainly as people that we know, like Ingrid Zundel and her husband.
The late Ernst Zundel.
We
just announced on False Flag Weekly News today that Ingrid had passed away not long after her husband Ernst. As we said, Tony Hall and I, as I said, I guess, whatever you think about their ideas, and I guess I would agree with some of them and disagree with some of them, and some of them are so bizarre I don't even know how to agree or disagree with, like the South Pole UFO stuff, you have to admit that these people suffered horribly for their right to free speech, and they wouldn't back down. And I admire that. You know, I'm very, very much dedicated to the idea that when, you know, you have something to say, you should stand up for your right to say it. And they did that, and they took the consequences and were, you know, practically martyred for it. And so I have to salute that. And, you know, I think we need more people like that. Now, people are going to take this out of context and say, oh, Barrett says we need more Holocaust deniers. But, yeah. Well, we need more people to question taboo subjects, to come to their own conclusions, and when they come to their own conclusions, to be brave enough to stand up in public and take the heat. And boy, did they ever take heat, man. The Zundels, oh boy.
here's what really I found out just today, that they knew of, if I got this right, and this is really fresh, so I'm not sure I'm getting it completely right, but it makes sense to me, that they knew of Ingrid's illness, her terminal illness, and it added extra sadness upon Ernst, perhaps even causing his death, or, you know, certainly weighing towards it, that he couldn't come and be with her when she was this ill.
This immigration situation was so crazy. I mean, the basic story, as I understand it, was he was in Tennessee with her, and they were somehow basically illegally extradited to Canada through this immigration violation claim that never would have happened if he wasn't a political dissident. So they essentially kidnapped him and took him to Canada illegally, did an extraordinary rendition, essentially, and put him on trial for his beliefs about politics and history. And I think he won one trial, and they retried him, and he lost, and they ended up sending him. Kept him in prison for a long time in Canada, and they sent him over to Germany to be in prison even longer. And then he can't get back into the U.S., where he was illegally renditioned to Canada in the first place, and Ingrid's here in the U.S., so they were kind of kept apart at the end of their lives.
Well, anybody else who had been married to a U.S. citizen gets to live here. But not if you question the religion of the tribe, because, you know, there's so many. I think Paul Eisen was the guy that really nails it. He says that so many Jews that are pro-Israel aren't religious. They're secular Jews. There may even be atheists, but they do believe in one thing, and that thing is the Holocaust. And when you cross that line, like Ernst did, proudly, because he was an ethnic German and wanted to come at it from the defense of his own people, that was just, you know, questioning Jesus Christ or Allah or God or what have you.
Well, no, it's much worse. You can question all those things here in the West and have no problems whatsoever. But if you ask these questions about the Holocaust, some of them good questions. And then, you know, I'm not an ethnic nationalist at all, so I can't relate to Ernst Zendel's sort of defense of the German people stuff. I guess I can sort of relate to it in that the German people were, in a sense, really given a bad rap, because most of them, like Monica Schaefer's parents, didn't know that there was any Holocaust. They never heard of any gas chambers. They never heard of any extermination plan. They went through the whole war with no idea whatsoever that there was any such thing. And then they've been vilified ever since as these horrible degenerates, you know, people who committed the worst crime in human history and so on and so forth. So I can kind of relate to that, But, you know, Ernst did have a kind of a nationalist side to him that I don't really relate to, as well as various other things. On the other hand, you know, that maybe that's what gave him the strength to do what he did.
Well, every time I spoke with and visited Ingrid down in Tennessee, you know, she was the first one that would agree with what you just said, that yes, we're going to say some things, and I'm going to agree with you on some things, and I'm going to disagree with you on some things. She was fully open to that. You know, she didn't go around proclaiming that she was right. She proclaimed some stuff, like you mentioned about the flying saucers and stuff, but they had, and they also talked about stuff about living forever, because they were going to have a cancer-free diet, or, you know, wholesome foods and that.
At least she never tried to get people who disagreed with her thrown in jail.
That's the big thing. I mean, doesn't that say a whole lot about what happened or didn't happen when you find somebody that's saying the earth is flat and you put them in jail? You know, we don't do that with any other subject that I'm aware of. And to me, it just plays into the hands of the revisionists.
Of course. Like, nobody's going to lock up Ernst Zendel for saying that the aliens came hundreds of years ago or thousands of years ago and created a base in the South Pole. And he can say that all he wants, and nobody's going to charge him with, quote unquote, falsifying history, making this false historical claim that aliens arrived 2000 years ago on the South Pole. Nobody, you know, but if he says, this questions the Holy Trinity of the Holocaust, the 6 million number, which of course even the father of Holocaust studies, Raoul Hilberg, says is wrong. He says it was 5 million, but whatever. Anybody else other than him questions the 6 million, and you're going to jail in Europe. And you question the Führer order and bureaucratic extermination program. Was this an actual planned extermination, a real government program? Was there any such program to try to kill all the Jews? If you say no, or I don't even, maybe not, then you get crucified. And if you question the gas chambers, well, lots of Jews were killed, lots of Jews died due to having been brutally ethnically cleansed. We agree with that. But if you say, I don't really see the evidence for the gas chambers, boom, you're thrown in jail.
Yeah,
this is, it's completely goofy, you know. So this idea that you can't falsify history, well, everybody has all kinds of ideas about history, and some of them, like the UFO base on the South Pole, are pretty goofy, but we can't run around throwing people in jail because they have goofy opinions about history. So yeah. Why is it that this one subject, the only subject of all the millions of crazy ideas people have, of perspectives on history that people have, the Turks don't think there was any Armenian Holocaust, and yet none of them get jailed for it. You know, there are Native Americans who say you say one less than 100 million of us were murdered by the evil whites, colonists. Yeah. Then you're a Native American Holocaust denier, but nobody's going to jail for that. And then the slave trade. I've heard some people say 20, 30 million dead in the slave trade. The official view on Wikipedia is like 5 million. And yet they're not called Holocaust deniers. And then we have Gideon Paglia telling us that 32 million Muslims have been murdered by the 9/11 wars. And the official estimate is vastly lower, but nobody's going to jail for that. So why is it that this one subject is getting lots of people imprisoned and persecuted, having their lives and careers ruined, being vilified? It's ridiculous.
I couldn't agree more. But it's very scary too that a small group of people can wield so much power. And the question that I would have for Jews, unlike myself, that have not washed my hands of the whole tribe, is how do they think, when history is really written, how kind is history going to be to the Jews who not only imprisoned Holocaust truthers, but they also have invaded and created an ethnic cleansing program for the last 70 plus years. You could probably argue it was more than 100 years in the planning, the Zionist conquest of Palestine, and the Jewish community has remained staunchly silent about that. Not only silent, they have cheered on the aggressors. How is history going to write that 94% of Israeli Jews cheered on the bombing of Gaza in 2008 or 2009, when those 3 weeks of intense bombardment were being, you know, I mean, what side of history do I want to be on? You know, I don't want to be on that side of history that defends that kind of ethnic cleansing. And I don't want to be on the side of history that burns books like Jeff Bezos is doing over there at Amazon and prohibiting their distribution because they question sensitive material, or material that makes a small portion of the public irritated. And you know what this whole knee jerk reaction of comparing us to Nazis, it's such a lockstep knee jerk, oh, you're a Nazi. Well, then that settles the whole thing. Once you get slimed with that accusation, then it's all over. And now the word, if Nazi doesn't work, then the word hate is being used. Well, Henry's a hater, and by association, then Kevin Barrett must be a hater too, because he has Henry on his show, and he isn't.
Well, yeah, I've heard people like in the first hour of today's show, we talked about the kind of criticism that some people have had. We had Joel Simpson on, and Joel told me that there are folks he knows in the kind of leftist Jewish community that have warned him against me. Don't deal with this Kevin Barrett guy. You know, he's bad news. I wish he were still here, because he would probably take issue with what he would probably view as your broad brush approach to the Jewish tribe. I mean, his view, yeah, which I agree with to a certain extent, is that people can't help, you know, what ethnicity they're born into. And so everybody is a human being, first and foremost, an individual human being. And when we lump people in a negative way, we have to be very, very careful about that, because it can easily devolve into bigotry and scapegoating. And that was the point that Joel made about the Peter Myers interview I did last week, when we were talking about Harvey Weinstein and his you know, his disgrace. You know, the specifically Jewish perviness of Weinstein, that tablet article that described how Weinstein was taking out his revenge fantasies on shiksa or non-Jewish women, and nobody else could talk about that. So I thought, we should be able to talk about this. And so Peter and I did. But Joel thought that that discussion, you know, where we were pointing out the totally Jewish-dominated nature of Hollywood and the, you know, heavily Jewish-influenced nature of the entire mass media, he thought that was over, you know, it was leading to a kind of a broad brush tarring of anybody who's born Jewish based on associating them with these negative characteristics. And so when we discuss any group and there's something about that group that we think is negative, for instance, we could be talking about Muslims in Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt or whatever, and their views of, let's say, homosexuality. And a lot of Americans, liberal Americans, would really not like the views that are predominant in that culture. You could talk about that ethnic group over in Egypt or in Saudi Arabia or whatever, talk about the culture, its view of homosexuality, and you wouldn't be slandering Egyptian Muslims or Saudi Muslims to do that as long as you're not lumping people, like all Muslims are bad because they hate homosexuals. That would be, you know, that would be the approach to, that would be lumping people under a negative label that leads to the kind of, you know, stereotyping and scapegoating that is dangerous and offensive. And so Joel thought that was going on with Peter Meyer's interview to some extent, or at least that was his first reaction looking at some of the talk that that interview generated. Well, I can see the point. So he might ask you about this. Like, are you doing a broad brush negative tarring of people who are Jewish?
I might be. I might be.
Are you plead guilty?
I think it's incumbent upon people who have been identified with an ethnic state, the Jewish state, to speak up when that state is acting badly or when that state was created under false pretenses and manipulated the international community to pass some BS laws that only got as far as the General Assembly and the United Nations and didn't go to the Security Council and has no bearing in weight. Why don't we talk about this? I don't want to play defense, Kevin, and I don't play defense. If I talk to Joel, I would say, you know, Joel, nobody flinches when we say Germans invaded Poland in 1939. Well, not all Germans, right? Well, who's going to whine about that we said Germans, but we didn't say, oh, not all Germans. I mean, nobody does that. We just say Germans did this. The Irish drink too much. Does that mean they? I hate Irish.
I find that's a bit offensive to hear you say that, Henry.
Yeah, right.
As an Irish Muslim, I find that extremely offensive.
Well, if you can, you can say that and don't go to vilified in the press. You know, why is it when you say Jews invaded Palestine in the 1900s and with an intent to ethnically cleanse the place and make it a Jewish state? I mean, you know, I don't understand the difficulty people have with the Palestine issue. I mean, I asked.
Well, I don't think Joel would have that problem either. But, you know, his issue was more with talking about Jewish cultural influence in Hollywood being a sort of degenerate force breaking down traditional Christian American values.
Well, he should read Gilad Atzmon then, because I'm just going through this for the second time, his second book called Being in Time. And he speaks to a lot of the influence that this minority has.
You're trying to break up a little bit.
I'm sorry. Is this better?
Yeah, I think so.
Straighten up a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay, I got to straighten my act out here. I think that Gilad really hits numerous nails on the head when he talks about Jewish culture and the power that is resides in the Jewish community. I mean, I don't know if J.J. Goldberg's book called Jewish Power, but it spells out exactly how much power Israel Firsters and the Jewish lobby have in the Congress of our country.
So can we criticize these kinds of things, you know, criticize the negative aspects of Jewish culture and Jewish power? There are people who kind of do nothing but that. They spend, you know, almost all of their communicative lives on the internet, essentially putting out, you know, a negative view of Jews in, you know, this area, that area, and the other area. And if you said to them, well, there are also these positive areas to Jewish culture. There's a lot of creativity. There's an emphasis on education in the family. As Joel Simpson said in the first hour, there are even some traditional Jewish family values that Jews didn't drink and they didn't, there was little, if any, physical abuse, so on and so forth. So is there a way to do this critique and do it in a balanced way? You know, I think the ultimate question is, are Jews being sort of protected in the acceptable mainstream discourse today far more than they should be vis-a-vis other groups? And certainly, like, vis-a-vis Arabs and Muslims would be the angle I would look at. And I would say the answer is yes, I think they really are. And therefore, airing out some of these critiques and this negative view is good and positive and called for in order to balance, to rebalance the overall discourse. But we don't want to go to the extreme of just focusing inexorably and totally on the negative side of Jewish culture.
But isn't that how balance is achieved? Okay. I mean, I always smile when I hear balance because, you know, both you and I know that the mainstream media, like you had just said, I mean, you answered your own question there, of course, but you were saying that the mainstream media has provided us over and over again with Jewish achievement, but more importantly, Jewish suffering. And I mean, how many, over 300 movies out of Hollywood on the Holocaust?
Yeah, sometimes it seems like the 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust, World War II, according to our dominant historiography, they get way more attention than the other, 54 million non-Jewish human beings killed in that war.
Well, yeah, that's part of the that's part of the power. I think that it. Quiver that the arrow called the Holocaust is the one that comes out and gets hammered, hammers everybody equally, I guess, because it really spells out that no matter how much you and I know that Palestinians suffer, their suffering can never compare to Jewish suffering in the Holocaust if we let that go. And to me, that's why it's important that we listen to some of the people that you claim that sit around and do nothing but critique Jews ad infinitum, where I think that does provide the balance. If you bring your wheel of your car into the mechanic and he sees that it's unbalanced, what he does is put weight on the other end, the diametrically opposed end of the wheel, right, to balance it. He's not going to put 5 ounces on both sides of the wheel, because that would just continue the imbalance.
Yeah, that's a good point.
To achieve balance, you do need to focus only on one side of the tire to put the weights on. That's how you achieve balance. I mean, I used to speak in front of city council with one of those legal weights, you know, and I would put some, you know, I'd show them that it was unbalanced to begin with. And to create balance, you have to put your pieces of pellets into only one cup. You know, you don't put them both sides. You don't have balance. That's the farce of people saying we don't want to have Henry speak because we need to have a balanced speaker to speak on the pro-Israel side. Well, you got the New York Times, you got the Washington Post, you got the Boston Globe calling the deeds of Israel. I mean, as if, you know, just, I mean, one of my Iraqi friends said it's like putting lipstick on a pig. You know, we really have to step back and say, what is this Jewish state? What is this support from mainstream Jewry for the state of Israel? What is this castigation and criminality of people like myself that question the right to exist as a Jewish state? You know, I don't question that. I say it don't have a right to exist as a Jewish state. France wouldn't have a right to exist as a Muslim state. I would speak up against that if they declared themselves a Muslim state.
Well, wait a minute. How could France possibly declare itself a Muslim state?
I just kind of threw that out there. Aren't there Muslims in?
I guess if you're going back 1,000 years,
and aren't there 2% of the population? They just got to get as much as powerful as the Jews. Uh-huh. And there, Joel, I said it again. I said the Jews. Oh, shame on Henry, right?
So if the Muslims can get as powerful as the Jews, they could turn France into a Muslim state and complete the conquest that the Spanish Muslims failed at 1,000 years ago.
I mean, America is almost a Jewish state at this point. I mean, we're an occupied territory.
Yeah, certainly with respect to Middle East policy, and this is where, but the cultural argument is definitely a little more complex. Where we have people like E. Michael Jones and Peter Myers that say that there is this Jewish domination culturally, and then Joel Simpson says not so much. Joel, I think was suggesting that these kind of cultural changes that have happened since the 1960s. With a loosening up of sexual morality and things like that, that people like Jones and Myers see as coming a lot of it out of Jewish Hollywood, which is bashing Christian culture out of this long sort of culture war against Christianity, whereas Joel thinks that the whole society is kind of evolving in that direction. It's not just Hollywood. It's not just Jews. The Christians are also stepping out of their traditional morality. It's happening because of the birth control pill, and there are these pendulum swings historically, and it's a very, very complex thing. And so I think Joel has a problem with oversimplifying by sort of blaming Jews for this entire cultural movement. And yeah, I think he does have a point that it is really just one factor. And maybe somebody like Mike Jones, who is a traditional Catholic, is naturally going to see it in a way that's just one piece of the puzzle. And whether that piece of the puzzle is important and needs to be aired and listened to and attended to, I guess, is a matter for us to disagree on. Joel didn't seem to think that Mike Jones was worth reading, but I've read his stuff, and I think it's very interesting and provocative.
Well, that's a good point to bring up when you say somebody like Mr. Simpson saying it's not worth reading, or he's trying to influence you, or he's trying to play the role of a gatekeeper. You should read this. You shouldn't read that. That to me is very very telling. It's very dangerous ground to go on, and I've railed against the people that join the Jewish people that join the pro-Palestinian peace movement because they achieve powerful positions, leadership positions, I should say, in these movements, and then they steer the conversation away from Palestine right of return, or they steer it away from being, which in my mind remains the last last pin holding up, supporting the state of Israel. I mean, you got the Balfour Declaration, you got the United Nations Partition Plan, you got God saying that the Jews should go to Israel. But all those three arguments kind of fall apart. And the only thing that's remaining is the Holocaust, because that underscores Jewish suffering. It underscores Jewish chosenness and specialness. And those are the things that if you're going to right out of the box defend or attack people that try to do broad brush stuff, I don't know where Joel's going to end up with that, because he's certainly already in my mind attempting to gatekeep. And he really needs to read Gilad Osman, because Gilad does talk about identity politics. He does talk about Jewish identity politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Gilad's work is very much worth reading. Very interesting stuff. You're fading in and out a little bit, Henry. Do you have a strong internet connection?
That's a good question. No, it looks pretty weak right now, as a matter of fact.
I hope Jessica Lieberman isn't sneaking around outside your house with a little gadget to mess with your internet.
Well, I wouldn't be a bit.
You wouldn't put it faster.
Yeah.
Or Victor, even Victor might be up to that.
There you go. Well, tomorrow is a work day for me.
Tomorrow's Saturday, so it's the wait, you're working on the Sabbath?
Well, that's what me and the rabbis, that's what we do. We work the Sabbath.
Yeah, you're sort of a counter rabbi, I guess, in Ann Arbor.
Well, the difference is he gets paid, and I.
Yeah, I imagine that the congregation doesn't drop a whole lot of shekels in your bucket as they walk by you with your.
That's true. I don't know if you viewers know. Last time we talked, there are counter protesters that show up at our vigils.
Well, that's great. They're giving more publicity.
And I find it very interesting, and maybe Joel would find it interesting, that the one counter-protester is Catholic lady. And she's, I'd say, elderly, and her name is Anne. And she, we decided early on to that we weren't going to try to convince each other of our points of views, but we were going to welcome each other as human beings. And she has really shown what I would call, and if I'm broad brushing Christians here, I mean this.
You know,
she's really shown Christian charity to us.
Wow, a counter protester.
Are we connected still?
Christian charity.
Yeah, she brought me. She delivered a tin full of Christmas cookies to my house.
Wow.
She brought brownies to the vigils and passed them.
I bet Victor and Jessica Lieberman have never sent you any gefilte fish. He's still there.
Don't think I've received it. Maybe it's waiting there on the doorstep. You're not aware. But then she was joined, and I think this was really interesting. She was joined by two or three Jewish ladies who don't give me the time of day and are very rude and curt to me. And in fact, one of the ladies stood in front of our anti-Israel flag, and I asked her to please move so that the passing traffic could see our anti-Israel flag. I'm not going to move, you know. I mean, it's just,
you know, if there are these supposed Jewish values, well, they're really being bared with this hostile attitude as compared to Anne, who shows some, you know, Christian kindness.
You know what I would do if I were in Ann Arbor is I would go out there and, you know, you've already got this great protest. You've got, you know, Henry the ex-Jew and his friends protesting the synagogue. And then you've got some Jews coming out counter-protesting against you. And then you've got a Catholic counter-protester, Anne. So I could be a Muslim counter-protesting against the counter-protest of Anne. And I could show you some Muslim charity and bring you some baklava. How's that sound?
That would be a challenge of the decade, I'll tell you that. maybe you want to, if you like, you might want to wait till the springtime when it starts to warm up a little bit, because now we're starting the cold weather. And
you'll still be out there in the cold.
We will be out there in the cold. In fact, last week it rained on the vigils. There was only one. Anne wasn't there. She was someplace else. She had an excused absence. And Sue, the Jewish protester, was out there. It started to rain. We opened up our umbrellas, and she just couldn't take it. She fled into the synagogue. I thought it was with great smiles on my face that I would.
No, maybe God didn't want her to miss the service.
We're nothing else, Kevin. We are dedicated.
It's really quite an amazing story.
You just never know about these things. But I really would recommend that the book from Gilad, because he talks about things like the Archie Bunker.
You're talking about the Wandering Who.
On the series that played in the second book, but though it might have been Wandering Who, I'm not sure. I'm talking about Being in Time. That's just
okay. Being in Time. That's the critique of identity politics.
Yes, yeah. And he, he explains that the left, driven by people like Norman Lear, who created the show Archie Bunker, and it was with humor where the straight patriarchal, if that's the way you pronounce the word, Christian upbringing that Archie was there, when he was made to look like a buffoon by his stepson, or I'm sorry, his son-in-law, Meathead. And so it was like this little banter going back and forth, but it actually taught liberals, if I get Gilad's point, it seems like he taught liberals, you know, how to be politically correct and how to make fun of Christian America, and how to denigrate the Christian right, and how to, you know, and they probably more than any are the ones that have caused this great chasm in the country right now. And I was not as surprised as a lot of my liberal friends because, you know, I motorcycle for pleasure and I go to, you know.
You're a biker.
And I have witnessed, I'm not quite a biker. We call ourselves motorcycle riders. Okay. I do about 10,000 miles.
I guess I'll try to be politically correct and
call you motorcycle riders. You can call me a biker, but I'm just not that tough, you know. Uh-huh.
I didn't know biker was pejorative. I'll be careful next time I run into a Hell's Angel.
Oh, that's right. Well, he might want you to call him a biker, so it's a difficult terrain you're on there. Wish I could help you out.
Yeah, political correctness is just getting too complicated for me these days. Huh?
Well, that's what Gilad writes about,
exactly.
The tyranny of political correctness. So like it's okay to stand for Palestine and you JVP Jewish Voices, you stand for Palestinian rights, but of course you don't stand in front of a synagogue. My God, how come you stand in front of a synagogue? Well, it's very simple. The synagogue is the place where Jewish chosen.
You're fading out pretty bad.
Jewish children. I'm so sorry. I don't know where the microphone is on this thing. Is this better?
Yeah, I think it's your internet connection.
Yeah, I wish I could.
You know, some people would say you shouldn't be out there picketing the synagogue. You should be picketing the studio headquarters where people like Harvey Weinstein are, you know, misusing their casting couches, that actually Jewish people should get back to their synagogues. It would be good for them and good for Jewish family values.
They I would certainly question those family values. I mean, we have really poked holes in that aspect of a Jewish culture because we, you know, that's the reason that they're so upset with us. That 15 years after we started our vigils, they're still writing full-page articles against us.
When was this recent article?
This is the October issue of the Washtenai Jewish News, October
18th. Well, it seems to me the Jewish press actually kind of thrives on this kind of stuff. I mean, they actually seem to, you know, they'll anything to make it look like there's some kind of anti-Semitic threat.
Well, sure. I mean, you could say, Henry, you're really doing them a favor by you know, you're allowing them to play the victim card once again. And say, well, I'm sorry about that. I do what I do. Because I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's the right thing to hold the Jewish community. That's where all the donations come from to the Jewish Federation, which makes no bones about supporting the State of Israel in their funding. You can see the same cars in the parking lot on Saturday mornings where I'll see them tomorrow as they are in the Federation's fundraisers once a year.
It does seem unfair that they can collect money for state terrorism by Israel. And, you know, terrorism is defined as intentionally attacking civilians to inflict terror on a civilian population, which is exactly what Israel does, especially when it mows the lawn in Gaza, kills a few thousand civilians every couple of years. But they do it regularly. They shoot down kids on sidewalks and schoolyards. They are, you know, the State of Israel is just a word for a ongoing terrorist attack against a civilian population. It's been going on for almost a century. And so that is terrorism. And so the synagogue is raising money for terrorism, and yet they're not being sanctioned for it in any way. Whereas if I, as a Muslim, try to raise some money for Hamas, which is counterterrorism, they're trying to defend the civilian victims of terrorism. That's what they do. I will be probably sent to Guantanamo. So it seems like there's a bit of a double standard here.
Well, there's a huge double standard there. You've hit the nail on the head. I mean, what I find interesting is that I get castigated for standing in front of a synagogue. But now Jewish women standing in front of a synagogue with political signs. They are committing political protests in front of this so-called house of worship. So it really underscores our long-held statement that it's not our presence on Saturday morning that bugs them so much. It's our message. It's our message that we're giving $10 million a day to the State of Israel. It's that we question whether there are members of Congress who are also citizens of a foreign government called Israel. You know, it's very embarrassing that we say no more wars for Israel. Well, what does that mean? Are we not fighting Iraq because of American interests? Well, that, you know, Iraq was no threat whatsoever to the United States. And it's become more and more clear that there were no weapons of mass destruction. I'm preaching to the choir here.
Of course. And even if there were, they wouldn't be a threat to the U.S.
That who caused us to go into this war? Well, yeah. Yeah, the United States had no interest in toppling Saddam. It probably upset the oil cartels because they were happy to
deal. That's what James Peck was right
it's really we've caught them in their own lie that it's not our presence on, you know, because why don't they complain about the Jewish women that are protesting in front of a synagogue? If that's the issue, you know, throw things at them too.
It certainly opened up an interesting area of discussion. And again, I kind of wish I lived a little closer to Ann Arbor so I could come and check it out. And maybe some of my listeners will. So this happens at what time every Saturday?
This happens at 9:30 in the morning, 9:30 to 10:45 every Saturday morning. At the address is 2000 Washtenaw Avenue in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
All right, be there or be square. Attend the synagogue.
Everybody is welcome.
Okay, everybody's welcome. Come out there on the High Holy Day and stand in the tradition of the prophets, the positive tradition of the prophets and the saints. Speaking truth to power. Well, thank you, Henry Herskovitz, for your courageous work. Keep it up, brother. We look forward to seeing you again one of these days. This is Henry Herskovitz.
Thanks much, brother.
All right. Take care. Henry is with Darusine Remembered and Witnesses for Peace. I'm Kevin Barrett of TruthJihad.com. See you next week for the live show. And you can find the other pre-records by way of TruthJihad.com. Click on the radio link. Until next time. Good night, and God bless. Thank you.